Good afternoon, everyone. If we can settle down, we want to start on the IPv6 session. Okay, let us start. This is the IPv6 workshop at the ICANN 47 meeting in Durban, South Africa, for those online. And it's taking place in room 3C, hall 3C. For this session, the agenda is going to be as follows. We shall have a brief update on the ASO and the NRO processes. Then we shall have our presentation from Hisham Ibrahim, who handles IPv6 issues at the AFRINIC office. He will present remotely. Then Jama Boba from the Cameroon government will share with us the IPv6 initiative carried out by the Cameroonian government, followed by Mark Elkins on the South African experience on IPv6 deployment. Then Andrew Alston will present remotely on IPv6 in research and education sector. We will start off with Wilbur, who shall present on behalf of the ASO and the NRO on the process, policy development process.
Hi, can I just ask, are the slides available on the ICANN website?
This is Carlos. The slides are available on the Adobe Connect room. They're not yet available on the website. I just received them.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll have Wilbur run us through this. Please, Wilbur.
Okay. Thank you, Fiona, for the introduction. Thank you for inviting us as a group, us being the Address Council. And while I myself personally have been involved in IPv6 things since more than a decade, this presentation is not really specific to IPv6 technology-wise, but we thought that it would be very useful for the community being interested in IPv6 to get some input and some guidance regarding the policy development processes that are applicable to IPv6 address distribution as they are to IPv4 address distribution. So this is mostly a brief background summary of why the Address Council does exist, what its main objectives are, and then I'm going to rush through a couple of slides that you may want to read up on at your leisure and offline, and then I'm going to put the focus on to how you can get involved and how the policy development processes are working. I've got just some 10 minutes for this presentation, and as I know that I'm well known for extending across each and every time-wise boundary, I'd ask Fiona to try to keep me within those 10 or 12 minutes. So, next slide, please. Why does the address supporting organization exist? It does exist because there is a memorandum of understanding between the community of regional internet registries and ICANN. The most recent version of that was signed on October 21st in 2004, so next year we can actually celebrate the 10 years anniversary. And this address supporting organization, or the Address Council in particular, has two basic jobs on their shoulders. One of them is to oversee the logistics of global policy development processes in the regions that lead to a global policy. And we are going to see what the definition for global policy is. And the other major function that has an influence on ICANN's dealings, ICANN's existence, is that this body elects two members of the board of ICANN. And we just went again through this process and put or re-elected one of the directors. So what is a PDP, or what is a PDP is the abbreviation for policy development process, and it's the framework within the community. And let me emphasize that the community actually flocks together, comes up with an idea, comes up with a proposal, walks through discussions, and eventually agrees on a consensus point of view on a particular issue. And this is in each and every region. This is, to start out, a regional policy. And there are lots and lots of them, and there are different sets of regional policies in the five regions, but there is a special version of those, and this is the situation where the same thing, the same issue, the same goal is pursued in each and every one of the five regions, and the five regions actually agree on the same text within their framework and within their region. And this is one of the requirements, so the text has to be the same in all the five regions. And in all the five regions, there has to be consensus. That's one requirement. The other one is that the policy actually has to have some sort of influence on the interaction with IANA, or the services offered by IANA, or any other input or influx on the behavior of ICANN towards other bodies. So this is sort of the background and the framework. Could you please go to the next slide? On this one, you can find the formal definition, what the global policy is. That's just the documentation version of what I tried to explain to you. And to emphasize here again, require specific actions or outcomes on the part of IANA. And IANA is this part of the ICANN organization that deals with numbers in particular of interest to the address supporting organization. Next one, please. So what does this thing look like? There are five regional internet registry regions, service regions, and each of those regions put three individuals into the pool of the 15 elected and appointed persons on the Address Council. Usually in the current version, per region, the two out of three per region are elected by the community, and the third one is appointed by the management of the regional internet registry. Global policy development oversight, ICANN board of directors election, I talked about this one already, but there are other duties which are put on our shoulders on a more individual basis, and that's, for example, that someone usually has to serve on the nomination committee, that we have been and currently are involved in various review teams. So, for example, I was on the Who is Policy Review Team, RT4, that was concluded last year. Fiona at the moment is at the ATR2. And there is also another colleague of mine, or actually two, being on the meeting, whatever the abbreviation is, the future meeting planning, whatever. And on sort of a sideline, we also have the job of answering the ICANN board's questions, should they come up with regard to number resources. So this is sort of in parallel to the formal policy development process. If the board has any open issues or any questions regarding number management, then we may receive a formal question to which we then do have to formally answer to the best of our knowledge. Next one, please. So coming back to the policy development process or the policy development principles, the cornerstone of the thing is this policy development is done in an open forum environment, and this open environment is put together by two components. One of the components is the mailing list, or mailing lists per region. Of course, this technology, this tool offers the capability to interact at any point in time and asynchronously. And then there are open policy meetings, and usually, almost always, they are in the framework of the regional meetings. The frequency of these meetings in the five regions is potentially different, so and they are not synchronized on the timeline. So if you start out to do a global policy development, we have to deal with the logistics that the meeting times of the five regions are not aligned and there are different numbers per year. So sometimes the members of the team, us, we have to go and we need to go to other regions' meetings to participate in the discussion and to actually get this thing going. But everyone is invited to join in here. Then the second thing is transparency. There is a documented policy development process both in each and every one of the five regions, as well as there is a formal description, formal documentation how to deal with global policies. So the policies that are agreed on eventually are documented and published, and also the meetings which lead to consensus and lead to those policies are documented. And sorry. The third cornerstone here is the bottom-up process. So everyone is invited to join in. It's consensus-based. And it's important to note here that the regional registries themselves or the staff members of regional registries do not come forward actively and propose policy or dictate policy, but they rather help this process along by way of participating in the discussion, contributing their assessment of effect or difficulties. And as soon as the policy has become policy, then the regional registries are expected to, as soon as possible, implement them. Next, please. So within this policy development framework, there are a couple of functionalities, a couple of roles. And, of course, the most important one is the role of the community, because it is the community which has to submit proposals, which has to participate in the discussions, and which has to converge eventually to consensus or not. Then there is the role of observing the discussion, maybe helping the discussion along, and eventually determining whether there is consensus. And this consensus evaluator role is implemented differently in the five regions. So in one or the other, it is an advisory council taking up that responsibility. It is the head or the coordinator of a policy, SIG, special interest group, or like in our RIPE region in Europe, it is the collective of all the working group chairs, and that's a pretty big group. And then there is the board functionality, and this is the role of guiding the thing along and trying to make sure that this converges one way or another, either into a consensus or into abandoning a particular proposal. And then there is staff involvement, and this is staff from the regional registries, and they are involved during the discussion period or close to the period when consensus is expected in the role of assessing the impact of the proposed proposal, the proposed policy, and to give feedback about difficulties, about, for example, financial aspects, or about inconsistencies with other boundary conditions and frameworks that might already exist. Sort of this is before consensus is declared, and then afterwards, of course, the RAR staff has to implement the policies, the decisions. Next, please. So let's have a closer look at the steps that are involved when it comes to global policy or also to regional policy. There is slight variations, but this is the major workflow. So someone has to submit the proposal, then we have to go through a community discussion phase, and the discussion has to take place on mailing lists and potentially on open forum meeting. Then there has to be an evaluation whether consensus has been achieved. And consensus in that sense here is very close to what the IETF defines as consensus. So this is not necessarily unanimous support, but that's sort of a reasonably big major majority being in favor. Then there is usually a last call function, and that's sort of a safety belt feature here to alert people that unless you speak up right now, you are not going to be heard if you are against a particular proposal. And then there is the adoption and ratification phase, and there is the implementation phase. And sort of that's the regular, the general flow of things. Next, please. The global policy process is pretty similar to that with regard to the fact that each and every global policy initially starts within the framework of a regional policy development. And the Address Council members are expected to join in if nobody else turns up, shows their hands, to submit a particular proposal to the regional fora. Of course, we as the AC members, we also do have an interest to get the process aligned on the timeline as good as possible, because there is no point in trying to have a global policy and then we end up with consensus in four of the five regions and the fifth one didn't even start the discussion. So we need to try to align the processes on the timeline. And sort of this is one of the things, this is before there is consensus in all the five regions, with the goal to achieve consensus in the five regions. And next slide, please. And then sort of we are going to get back into the loop, because as soon as the five regions have agreed on a common text, this common text is forwarded to the NRO, to the Number Resource Organization, and it comes back by that route to the ASOAC. And during this phase, our responsibility is to review the formal environment, the logistics, whether everyone has been heard, and whether arguments or contributions in favor or against the proposal have been taken care of and considered. And if this is the case, then there is a formal decision in the Address Council to propagate this policy to the ICANN board for adoption. And the usual reaction to that is that the board ratifies this proposed global policy, and by that it becomes global policy, and then the Internet Assigned Names and Numbers Authority and the RARs go ahead and implement this global policy. This, on the slides, and probably by my expectations, looks and sounds more difficult and more complex than it is in real life. If you're interested, just begin to join in. Read a couple of discussions about policies, regional ones or global ones, and try to get involved in that. So next slide, please. And this is actually the the focus and the real reason why I'm talking to you in this room here is to advertise to you and to entice you to get involved. How can you do that? First of all, you can watch the news, you can watch some mailing lists. There is in all of the regions usually a particular mechanism or mailing list to distribute the announcement that work is about to start on a particular issue. So this is one of the things. The other things that I would urge you to consider is to participate in your regional policy discussion environment. And the your region here is not necessarily just the one you are physically living in or your business or technical interest is focused in, because there is no formal membership in these discussion groups. Wherever you are living around this world or on the moon, you are welcome to join in. And even if you are based in Africa, for example, you are welcome to join in the European discussions and the other way around. There is, during the meetings, most of the time during the address policy related meetings, there is also remote participation. In some regions and in some environments, this is not as fancy as the ICANN environment. Sometimes it's just a Jabber or chat channel, but still this is one way of getting involved. Next slide, please. So participation is easy. Just try to do it. Subscribe to the regional internet registries policy lists. As I said, no formal membership. You do not need to live or have any physical interest in that region to participate. And please attend the meetings in person or on remote technology, and we'd like to see and hear you in these environments. Next slide, please, which brings me to the end. And if there are any questions, I hope that I'm able to answer them, or one of my fellow AC members might be in a better position to do that. Thank you. Back to Fiona.
Thank you, Wilbur. Any questions? Well, I'm not seeing any hands coming up. In the absence of questions, or as you're thinking of your questions, I think I shall move on to the next presenter, Hisham. So, Carlos, kindly get Hisham.
This is Carlos Reyes. We have to call Hisham so that we can get his audio in. If you could just give us a few minutes, we need to pause for a short break. Thanks.
Okay. So, any questions? I will take this time to introduce then the other members of the ESO who are here representing their different regions. How many am I seeing? I'm not seeing everyone. So I'll ask those who are in. Please introduce yourselves. If you're near a mic or move close to a mic, introduce yourself.
I'm Ron DeSilva from the Aran region.
Okay. My name is Tomohiro Fujisaki from APNIC region.
Hans-Peter Holin from the RIPE region.
Dmitry Kovmanyuk, RIPE region.
Hello.
Then Wilbur is from RIPE, and have you managed to get Hisham?
Okay. Yes, Fiona. Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello, Hisham. We can hear you.
Yes, I can hear you very well. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect. Can I get my slides up?
Slides are going up shortly.
Thank you. Okay, so until they go up, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Hisham Ibrahim. I am the IPv6 program manager at AfriNEC. I will try to be brief because I know how painful remote presentations are. We're already facing some technical difficulties here. So let me first talk about AfriNEC. For those that do not know, what AFRINET is. So AFRINET is the regional internet registry that serves the African region. We provide internet number resources as well as other services as well. But for the purpose of these slides, I will only focus on IPv6 in Africa and AFRINET. Slides up yet. So until the slides are up, let me. Yes, okay, slides up. Okay, great. So next slide, please. Yes, so these are some of the registration services trends that we have been seeing over the past couple of years. As you may have noticed, that all the way up to 2010, we were only giving out a handful of assignments of IPv6. But in the year 2010, that number increased dramatically, simply because of all the communication that was being made then about global IPv4 depletion. As you can see as well, in 2011, that spike really went up, because that was the year of the global IANA IPv4 runouts. You can see the numbers going down a bit in 2012 and 2015. We had hoped the trends kept on going up, but it's understandable. You'll probably see similar graphs from other regional internet registries as well. Next slide, please. So, yes. So, some of these trends that I was mentioning, the increase of number of requests in 2011, as you saw. Today, we have almost 54% of the new members that are registering at AFRINET in the year 2013 that have requested an IPv6 prefix by themselves without us needing to tell them, are you interested in IPv6 and do you know what IPv6 is? So that actually shows that the community now, the African community now, is more aware of what IPv6 is, the issues, and they want to actually start deploying it from day one since they get their initial resources. We also have in our new members guidebook that also has information about all the relative AFRINET services, including IPv6. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So the next slide will be trends of IPv6 advertisements globally. I still haven't seen the slide move yet, so I'm going to continue speaking unless told otherwise. So the graph you will be seeing is the percentage of autonomous system numbers that are globally seen over IPv6. And you can see over time, since 2005, we had around 5.5%. It grew in the beginning of 2011 to 6. During 2011, you can see the slope became really steep, and we had like a 200% increase. So we were at 11.2%, and now we're almost at 14% visibility. I'm sorry, can I get an indication that you can hear me? Because the slides aren't moving.
Hisham, we can hear you clearly, and everyone is paying attention to what you're saying and to the slides.
Okay, perfect. I just couldn't see the slides moving on the remote platform. So if you can see the slides, I am actually now on slide 5 that has all the 5 regional RIRs and the percentage of their IPv6 global visibility. So So as expected, the top two ones are IPNIC and VIPNCC. And these two RIRs are the two RIRs that actually reached their final slash eight. And as was mentioned in the previous presentation, each region has policies that are developed regionally of how to deal with the last slash eight assignment, so which is called soft landing policy. So these two regions now can only allocate small blocks of IPv4 to their members, and this is why IPv6 deployment is taking off more, and that's what makes it so logical for the first two RIRs to be APNIC, the one that first ran out, and the IPNCC at 20 and 18%. The other three RIRs, as you can see, 15.7% for LACNIC, AFINIC almost 14%, and the ARIN region around 12%, 12.44%. The next slide has the AFINIC IPv6 initiatives. I just have this slide for purposes that you can actually go back and look at these links. I'll just run through them really quick. We have the IPv6 trainings that AFINIC does. We have the website. You can go visit that. It has the next upcoming AFINIC training schedule and the modules that we teach. There is the African IPv6 Task Force that has the IPv6 webinars that AFINIC does in collaboration with ISOC and France Telecom. You can see the archives of the past previous webinars on that website. They are in both English and French. There is the IPv6 program page that has information from how to start and frequently asked questions about IPv6. To transition mechanisms and more advanced topics in the African region and from the NRO perspective as well. There's the Tinga Tinga project, which is a tunnel broker service that AFINIC offers in southern and western Africa. You can read more about it at the URL there. I won't take too much time talking about this now. And there is the IPv6 statistics as well. All these URLs you can find on the presentation afterwards. My final slide has the NRO IPv6 survey. So if you go to www.afinic.net, you would find on the main page these two indications of the NRO survey. And I would request everybody in the room to take 3 to 5 minutes to fill the survey. This is a global survey that the NRO, which is the umbrella organization for the five RIRs, has conducted for the past 4 years. And we use that information to know how IPv6 is viewed and monitored and planned from a global perspective and on a regional perspective as well. So if you please could take 3 to 5 minutes, go to www.afinic.net and fill that survey, it will really help. We will put that information to good use. Thank you very much. I won't take too much time, and that was my slides. I'm here for questions.
Thank you very much, Hisham. Any questions from the floor for Hisham? Hello? Any questions for Hisham? Okay, Hisham, turns out you're very clear and well understood, and there are no questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll be on the remote chat if there anything comes up. Thank you.
That will be great, Hisham. Thank you. We shall move on to our next speaker, who is Jama Boba, to share with us the Cameroonian experience on IPv6 deployment. The floor is yours, Boba.
Thank you, Chair. before coming to IPv6, let me briefly highlight some ICT environment in Cameroon. Um, The ICT situation in Cameroon, the government is in charge of definition of policies, strategies. So like the topics like e-government, analog and to digital TV global plans, how to reach rural area and guarantees to guarantee access to internet with cheap prices. And in this case, concerning e-government and transition from analog to digital TV, now the government has already developed a strategy to move on, and we are implementing that strategy. In the field of developing access to internet for low cost, lower cost, and the telecom development fund was established to support development of access, particularly in rural areas, with the contribution of telcos and ISPs, about 1.5% of their turnovers. Then let me highlight a bit concerning regulation. In Cameroon, we have some actors, the Ministry of Post and Telecommunication, who is responsible, as I said, for vision policies, regulation, and ICT strategies. We have also one national advisory for competition, two regulatory agencies, Telecom Regulatory Board and National Agency for ICTs, who is the root CA, and also National Computer Incident Response Team, and managing also the CCTLD of Cameroon. And we have also four telcos, one incumbent, and three mobile operators, and about 50 ISPs. The Telecom Regulatory Board regulate the market concerning telecommunication on the basis of an existing regulation, and the National Agency for ICTs, ANTIC, is responsible, as I said before, managing the CCTLD. And since 2012, ANTIC organized several meetings with the telcos and ISPs, to even with the civil societies and international development partners such as ITU, UNDP, to solve problems related to the development of the internet in Cameroon. We discussed about the establishment of internet exchange points. As a result, the Cameroon Internet Exchange Association has been created to manage the IXPs. And once the IXP is operational, we intend to contact Afrinic to help us in order to get a copy of a root server. Then we come to IPv6. This year, a National Agency for ICT put a multi-stakeholder committee to develop a strategy for migration from IPv4 to IPv6. This committee includes government agencies, ministries related to the subject, academia, telcos, ISPs, and ISOC Cameroon chapter, and even Afrinic. So this committee is in charge of developing the strategy and follow up its implementation in Cameroon. So as I said, it is a bit embryonic. So, and before finish my presentation, let me highlight a bit some initiatives concerning IPv6 and IXPs. Last week, ISOC and African Union held a training in Yaoundé, National Cameroon capital, concerning internet exchange point. And the National Agency for ICTs organized some trainings concerning security audit, computer incident response team, with the support of World Bank this year, 2003 and 2013. And some training are on progressing now. Even now, today, there's a training concerning IPv6 in Yaoundé by Afrinic, and also the training concerns security cert and security audit with the support of IMPACT, International Multilateral Partnership Against Cyber Threat of ITU. It's ongoing training now. And finally, Cameroon has set up a root CA and government CA platforms using PKI. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you so much, Boba. Any questions?
Yes, please.
Introduce yourself.
I am.
Use this one.
I am Kem Delungweke, and I work for Digital Science Africa, an ICT perception management organization. We're into IPv6 awareness creation, but most of the time, the problem I have when questions come up, like, what's the implication for the end user? In my country, I know we have about 29 allocations, but I don't know if the OptoTrader has deployed. I know of only one now, and a university. I know Phase 3 Telecoms has deployed, like they said in the last forum, which my company organized on awareness creation for IPv6. But the question has always been, how does it affect us, the end users? That's the question they ask all the time, because we tell them that it's an improvement from 4, Internet Protocol version 4, and we still tell them that Africa still has 4, and that's probably why some have not deployed. But the question still remains, what is the implication? As an end user, how does it affect me? That is what they ask. I would like that question answered. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kem. I think that will be answered by Hisham. If he's still online. Okay, we will reserve it for him. Any other question? Then we will move on to our next speaker, Mark Elkins, who will share with us the South African experience on IPv6 deployment. Mark, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon. I do have a slide set there. Ah, great. Okay, so my name is Mark Elkins. I wear a number of hats. One of my hats is I'm a member of the board of Afrinic. I gave a presentation 2 years ago in Dakar in 2011, and so what a lot of these slides do is compare the situation in 2011 to where we are today. There's another section on an update on our IPv6 peering, and one of my other hats is I'm also very involved in the CCTLD so I can or have drawn some stats from that. Can we go on, please? Okay, difficult to see, but the blue bit on the left-hand side, it would be members by country, and about 45% of AFRINIC members are actually from South Africa, so we do make up a fair amount. Now, that was in 2011, and I have a number, 534 people, 534 people. If we go to the next slide, the format is slightly different. AFRINIC have changed things, but again, it's the total number is now 547. So the number of members increase in South Africa from an AFRINIC point of view is very, very small marginal change. So no great differences there. If we go on to the next slide, we have IPv4 resources from South Africa, which makes up about 46% of IPv4 sits in South Africa, and there is a number. Oh, anyway, yeah. So it's about 46%. And moving on to the next slide, that number more or less stays the same. The color percentage of the pie chart is more or less the same. Moving on to the next slide, which is the first IPv6 slide, we'll see that 25% of addresses in Africa are sitting in South Africa. And here we have 158, I think it is. Is it? It should be about 158. 25%. So how has that moved? If we move to the next slide, that really has not changed at all, except it went from 58 to 89 allocations. So South Africa is growing as quickly or as slowly as any other part of Africa, and it's maintaining its percentages. So growth, I would say, is consistent, and no great changes there. If we move to the next slide. Next. If we can move that up a little bit. In 2013, some exact figures here. 6XS said we had 68 allocations, 32 which are visible. The numbers do seem to differ from the pie charts on AFRINIC. I cannot explain that. On the other hand, in 2013, we seem to have had a lot more allocations brought out to us, and there's something like three times more people visible now on IPv6. So in 2 years, we've tripled, which I think is reasonably good growth. If we move on to the next slide. Back in 2011, these are figures from research that I've been doing on the exchange point. In 2011, we had 58 devices connected, which basically accounted for 32 different people peering, or organizations peering at the Johannesburg Internet Exchange point. At that time, 8 people were using IPv6. Today, the figure looks much healthier. We have 72 devices, which is now 58 members, of which 27 are using IPv6. So what I can definitely state is that more and more people, more and more ISPs are certainly using IPv6. More people are connecting at the exchange point, which is, of course, excellent news, and a greater percentage of them are definitely using IPv6. So generally speaking, there is reasonable growth. Should I take this question? Yes.
Are you done?
No. Question.
Could you please wait until...
Oh, okay. He wants to wait. Okay. And then the last slide. I went and had a good look, because I have access to this information, at the... If we move up to the next slide... Oh, thank you. Oh, that's thank you. That's great. The last slide shows if your name server has IPv6 glue, how many domains are sitting on that name server. Unfortunately, I seem to peer quite often because I like playing with IPv6. But essentially, this shows us that we have 7 different ISPs. There is the 1s through to 6, and the 7th would be myself. There are a fair amount of domains using IPv6 glued name servers. There are obviously a whole bunch of other name servers sitting in South Africa which do not have glue records because they're not in Bailiwick, or that they're not describing themselves with their address. So this is just the view that I have. And to confirm that, if we have a look on the right-hand side there, at the time of this presentation being prepared, there were 295 customers coming in with EPP into the CO.za system. Of those 295, 90 were using IPv6 transport to get in, which would suggest that about 1/3 of all ISPs in South Africa are using IPv6 in reality to get across the exchange point and into the COSA system, the EPP system. The figures are very badly skewed, though, because 83 of those are from our one large ICANN-accredited registrar, which is Data Matrix. But it does mean that people are using IPv6 to do everyday business within South Africa itself. The other funny on that is the last name server on there, after me playing around with Jekyll and Hyde, is xn-caf-dma. So we are allowing people to sneak IDN into South Africa, even if it's not meant to be there. And the only other thing that I can mention is we do have a presentation by Palesa from the South African government or not?
We have from the educational network.
Okay, I understood that the DOC was going to give a presentation. As they're not, I can also state that there is a South African IPv6 task force to the government. That's been running for the last 2 years, and we kind of gave the first paperwork over to the South African government a couple of months ago, so they hopefully do have a clear idea of what is necessary to migrate over to IPv6. We're still expecting feedback from that paper. So the government is certainly involved in the move towards IPv6 in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Dan, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Mark, if you could go back a slide up here to the slides that you were comparing, these right here where you're comparing the number of devices and the members. When you say 27 people peer with IPv6, is that 27 of the 72 devices or the 58 members? Just curious.
That's of the 58 members.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Wilbur, you have a question.
Yeah, I'd like to come back briefly to the statements about the EPP usage of IPv6 as a transport, because this looks like a success story. And on the other hand, to the issue of glue records, and in particular the glue records for the delegated zones. Did you do any investigation whether the parent zone was at that point in time supporting IPv6 glue records, or whether there was the situation that the authority to name servers themselves were already capable of IPv6 transport, but the tree walk was broken for V6 because one of the parent zones was not supporting that, either technically or by way of provisioning through the registrar?
We didn't do too much research on this. It's simply people who have put in IPv6 glue. So they are advertising the fact that we can get to those people can get to those names using IPv6 transport. So they weren't all checked. I can say that the ones that I'm running are certainly reachable and advertising on IPv6. I presume others do the same.
Yes, Graham.
Hi, Graham Benneke here. One of those obfuscated servers is mine, so they're also working on V6. The question I had for Mark was, you mentioned the IPv6 task force. On the ground, I haven't seen anything that the IPv6 task force is doing for the industry. Is it only feeding back into government at this stage?
The paper that's been prepared is a preliminary paper, and it's been given to Palesa, who we eventually discovered was the person who was asking for the paper before handing it over to the minister. So it's confidential at this point, I guess you can say. But I'm assuming that the government will share the findings, as that's one of the things that we put into the paper.
Okay.
Please forgive me. I'm asking as a layperson because I'm not a technical person when it comes to matters like this. I'm just curious. Is there anything you're doing specifically in terms of awareness or so? Because a lot of ISPs deployed IPv6 here in South Africa, but compared to my country, I really like to know if there are certain things you're doing that we are not doing. And I mean, the difference in the deployment status of South Africa, IPv6 and Nigeria. I'd just like to know if there are things you're doing differently, why the ISPs are actually deploying this, and why we are not, why the ISPs in my country is not, like, taking that up. Thank you.
I'm going to take that question as, why are South African ISPs deploying IPv6, and why are not Nigerian IPs doing the same too? What are we doing special? I have no idea why we're special.
Sorry.
We have been talking about IPv6 at our meetings, our regional meetings. We've been pushing down people's throats that it's a good idea to change. We are well aware of the fact that Afrinic, yes, does have 2 or 3 years to go before potentially at its current run rate will run out. But there was some policy at the last Afrinic meeting in Lusaka where educational establishments may find it easier all around Africa to get IPv6. And if every educational establishment was to do a run on this, then it would mean that we would actually move into we basically run out of IPv4. And I hope that happens. I hope that happens because maybe that can be a wake-up for Africa. I've always been a supporter of the fact that if the whole world went over this waterfall at the same time, then it would force everyone clearly to look at deploying IPv6. The problem is, if other parts of the world are moving over and only deploying IPv6, then there's potentially IPv6-only customers out there. But if we're happy on our little IPv4 islands, we're not going to be reached by these people, neither are we going to be able to reach those other people. There is a potential, I guess, for the internet to become sort of split. Those who have only IPv4 and those who only have IPv6. So I don't want to see that.
Actually, Mkem, if you can give time to Andrew Alston to share his presentation, we'll get a bit more insights on the issue from that.
Because I'm disturbed because coming to what he just said lastly, that there are likelihood that when others deploy 6 and we're still in 4, it may not be compatible, may not be able to. I think that was what we talked about when we did the first IPv6 workshop 20, 2010, and that was the idea we had. We thought that because they said there was this IPv6 test flight there. Am I mistaken? That was to take place in 2010, June the 8th. So that was the impression people had. But that day, it turned out that people could still access even websites that were running on 6. So it didn't really matter to the end user. Thank you.
Okay, let me just help you understand what happened. In 2010 and 2011, the ISOC and a lot of the industry had a drive to test IPv6. So it was the 6th of July in June 2010 when there was the first trial, and it was pretty much a trial in 2010 yes. to see and to also be able to collect data on how many for example, how many networks were IPv6 ready, how much content was IPv6 ready, to check the level of preparedness globally on IPv6 readiness. So that was a test. And then in 2012, there was an agreement to now switch over the networks and the content that was IPv6 ready to now be turned on and to continue running on V6. So that has happened, yes. And yes, networks are still accessing content yes. because for the time being, a lot of those who are IPv6 ready are doing it in a dual stack mode. That means they are running both IPv4 and IPv6 on their networks at the same time. So for now, the end users in most parts of the world are somewhat comfortable, but there are regions where the change is being felt, like in the EPINIC region, and I'll probably ask one of my colleagues from the ESO to just share the experience from the EPINIC region. So when you ask the question on the implications on the end users, it varies from region to region based on a number of factors, including the speed at which the region is taking up the IPv6. Maybe Paul Wilson will be able to just add more to that.
Sure, I'm happy to. I'm Paul. I'm from APNIC, which is the IP address registry for the Asia-Pacific. And if I can give a brief plug, APNIC did get the chance to include a document in the meeting bag here, which is a paper about the status of IP addressing in the 2010s in this particular time, and it does talk about the dynamics of IPv6 deployment and IPv4 exhaustion. So it might be that the point of that paper is actually to be as much as possible a layman's guide, so it might be useful. It talks about issues like the one that you raised about the difference to end users, and the trouble is that by design there is no difference to an end user in having IPv6 provided to them. There's no immediate difference. IPv6 is designed to carry exactly the same services as IPv4 and to do so in invisibly. So that what that creates is a useful thing because users don't have to know any different, but it also creates an unuseful thing, which is that users don't demand IPv6. So they're not bashing on the door of the ISPs for IPv6, and the ISPs, of course, don't need... they've got plenty of other things to do, but what they're not doing is bashing on the door of the vendors looking for IPv6 products either. So there's a sort of vicious circle of lack of incentive at the moment. But the incentive for IPv6, in spite of what people may have been saying for the last 10 years, there's really about the benefits of IPv6. There's really only one incentive, which is addresses. It's the lack of IPv4 addresses. And in the APNIC region, and now also in the RIPE region, we don't have IPv4 addresses left except in very small rationed quantities for network deployment. So any large IP network deployment today, any new deployment, has to be based on either IPv4 in a private addressing mode with carrier-grade network address translation or with IPv6, or preferably actually both, because the point is that when users do notice the difference, and it can be a very big difference, is when their ISP has got no more public addresses to provide and the ISP provides a private address instead, and that can immediately create performance problems and reliability problems. And it's been well studied. The technical effects have been well studied, and it is definitely something that users will notice. So what the ISP who is deploying that, the private addresses, needs to do is to provide IPv6 at the same time. And if they're doing that, then the user who then uses their connection to access an IPv6-enabled website, like you actually have on quite a few of the major content providers, that user will get a perfectly good connection and will avoid the problem that they may have in accessing IPv4 sites at that time. So the whole point here is that it's about readiness on the part of the ISP. There are many ISPs at the moment in the world who do not need to deploy IPv6 today. They won't get a benefit from doing it today, but they will get a lot of benefit from being ready today. And so what we're trying to impress upon the industry is that readiness for IPv6 is really important, and that includes planning. And for some people, and in South Africa, for instance, readiness seems to have allowed them to deploy IPv6. Once you're ready, in fact, in many cases, you can deploy it straight away anyway. In other cases, you may be ready, but you know that you need certain things to be done. And and that planning process is something that's really important, so that anyone who's got any reliance on the internet today really needs to have to understand that they are going to be reliant on IPv6 very soon, and whatever their product or service is, whether they're a user of an ISP service or a user of some equipment or a user of consulting people who provide internet-related advice, or whether they use data centres or hosting services, wherever they have an internet service of any kind, it is useful to understand when that is going to be an IPv6 compliant service. And depending on how valuable the internet is to you, it's really a valuable and important question, in proportion with your reliance on the internet. So for end users at this stage, they're not banging on the doors of their ISPs, but I can tell you that when an ISP, and some of them are doing this now, when an ISP decides to trial a private addressing service to their users, they generally find that their costs and their problems go up considerably. And when it comes to large-scale broadband deployment from ISPs, they do not want to have to answer support calls. Every support call or every problem that is generated actually probably sacrifices the profit margin from that particular user for 6 months or so. I mean, such are the margins. So an ISP does need to take this seriously and be ready and not be in a position where they sort of don't have IPv6 readiness, they don't have IPv4 addresses, they need to do some networking, they waste a bunch of some network deployment, they waste a bunch of money on carrier-grade NAT, create a whole bunch of problems for themselves, and that's exactly the wrong formula. So I hope that's helpful, but again, I'd refer you to that paper that's in the ICANN pack if you'd like to know some more.
Thank you so much, Paul. Quickly, we're just going to... There's a question from Leo to Mark, which we shall take. Then immediately after that, we will go to our next presenter. He has 30 slides. Andrew, you may need to shorten your presentation slightly so that we can fit into the time. And then we'll take on the rest of the discussion offline, if that is okay. Carlos, can you read out?
This is a question from Leo Vagoda. What proportion of traffic crossing the networks is IPv6? And that question is for Mark.
Could I perhaps answer that one?
Yes. Yes, Graham.
Graham Binnicker from Jinx. Currently at Jinx, our current switch vendor doesn't support S-Flow, NetFlow, Flow Export, or anything like that. So we unfortunately don't have statistics of that as much as we'd love to have them. So we're working on replacing our switch fabric with something that will be able to give those statistics. Anecdotally, I can tell you that across the network that I run, up to 10% of my traffic is IPv6. I'm not going to steal Andrew's thunder, but I think he has a far more impressive figure.
Thank you so much, Graham. Is Andrew online? please call him.
Hi.
Hello, Andrew.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you okay. And we have a special request. Due to time constraints and being that the room is going to be used by a different group, I'm kindly requesting if you could reduce your presentation slightly. I will give you about 15 minutes.
Not a problem. There are slides that I can brush over a bit.
Thank you.
Okay, first of all, thanks to everybody. This presentation that I'm going to give is actually one that I gave a little while back with a co-presenter from the university on whose behalf I'm actually presenting here. And it looks at an IPv6 deployment at a university, and I think some of the things that we encountered in this whole rollout actually turned out very, very interesting, and they're slightly unexpected. But basically, to start off with, how this whole started was the university had a network that had a couple of problems. To give you an idea, we had 19,000 wired ports on that network, 150-plus CCTV cameras, over 500 switches, loads of wireless access points, and 1/16 worth of legacy IP space. That's the network. That's a pretty large network. However, what we didn't have was any routing protocols, VLAN segmentation, working multicast, V6, no IP planning, no QoS implementation. There was, basically, it was a straight flat network as if it were plugged into one giant hub. So what we really had was one broadcast domain, overloaded ARP tables, our switch utilizations were sitting in excess of 90%, we were getting broadcast storms all over the place, spanning tree and topology loop issues, and while this slide says a disaster waiting to happen, the reality is it wasn't really a disaster waiting to happen, it was a disaster as it stood. So we needed to change this, and we decided we needed to make a plan, and we came up with a number of steps to do this. Figure out what our objectives were, figure out how we get there, if we have prerequisites, obtain them, then plan our deployment, implement extremely carefully, resolve all the unforeseen issues, and then critically do skills transfer to the rest of the staff who have to keep maintaining this network. Now, in our objectives here, this is where the V6 actually comes in, and it gets really, really interesting from this point forward, because we needed a design that was scalable. Now, V4 has limitations of scalability, particularly in how this campus is growing, even with more space. We had to cater for the deployment of V6. That was absolutely mandatory. We wanted the deployment of multicast technologies in both V4 and V6. We still haven't got there yet, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. We wanted to cater for IP telephony, greater flexibility, get rid of the single broadcast domains, and at the same time, in doing all of this, we didn't want to overcomplicate, and we wanted to get rid of all network address translation. NAT was just causing way too many problems with end-to-end connectivity, and in a research environment, that simply doesn't work. So we went and looked at what design we could choose, and we built the network on service provider principles, basically on the theory that a university provides its students access, it provides its staff access, and typically an SP design is more flexible than a standard enterprise design. So on the design principle, we segmented the network core distribution edge. We wanted to use ISIS on this network primarily because it gives us one single protocol for V4 and V6 all the way back. I know that now with OSPF you can do V4 and V6 with one instead of running OSPF 2 and 3, but we were kind of stuck because we couldn't do ISIS, so we went with the OSPF. We went with BGP for the majority of the table. Unfortunately, that was only for V4 because the vendor that we were working with didn't support V6 under BGP. Got rid of the VLAN spanning, and we're using PIM for the multicast routing. Again, the vendor didn't support MSDP. Now, one of the things this slide highlights is that there were vendor limitations in what we could do. I mean, ideally, we wanted to run the BGP on the V6, you know, run a single IGP. It just wasn't an option. So that does come up in V6 deployments. Then, when we looked at the problems and the prerequisites, we needed the network properly segmented before we could roll out. And normally segmenting the network is going to result in large amounts of downtime due to subnet mask issues, and we needed some extra licenses. Now, when I talked about the downtime because of subnet mask issues, this is actually a critical issue, and it actually demonstrates a very interesting use of V4 that you have gone and got from your RIR. When you typically have a single broadcast domain and you need to segment something off, you've either got to do something like proxy op, or you've got to put that in a completely separate subnet that is not overlapping the other range, else things start not being able to talk to each other. So because we had a single /16 subnet there on the V4, we couldn't just randomly subnet, and it created a fairly complicated issue. So what we did was we went to Afrinic and we asked them for more IP space. We needed this anyway to get rid of NAT, but it also made this whole transition period a lot, it was really, really simplified things with that space. Interestingly enough, the space that we did get, Afrinic will be happy to hear, is now 100% utilized on the campus. So we then looked at it, got more space, and decided we were going to renumber while slowly reducing the size of the original broadcast domain and rolling out IPv6 at the same time. Did a very very comprehensive planning exercise, and this included both the planning for the V4 and the V6, proper subnetting, proper IP deployment plan, proper VLAN planning, etc. So we put in all the planning, and you'll see there's a couple of further planning details. I'm not going to go into huge detail here, but basically the essence of these two slides is that we planned and planned and planned to get this right before we did anything, because we didn't want to break anything. And if you're deploying IPv6, that's the one piece of advice that I can give to anybody, and particularly in large environments like university campuses and the academic sector. That planning is so, so critical, or if you're going to create yourself more nightmares than you want to know with downtime and the rest of it. You can see here, this is a slide of the IT plan where we did our V4 planning. Most of our V6 planning was actually done in Excel spreadsheets, because this time this didn't actually support V6. Then we also, there's another slide of how we started doing the planning there. We used a couple of management tools. This is NetDot. The nice thing about NetDot is it does V4 and V6. It supports it, fully integrated with the DHCP and the DHCP V6. I'm going to brush over these because of time limitations, but this is a tool well worth looking at if you are using V6 on a network. It also does some pretty nifty things like drawing your topologies. Then we got to the implementation. We decided we were going to implement this, basically created second VLANs for each distribution, trunked it down to the cores, put the /30s in place, and basically step by step roll this out, but in an overlay network without touching the production network. So we managed to build all the VLANs, all the routing, everything else without actually ever affecting production traffic. We had no downtime doing this. Then enabled the multicast, made sure the DHCP scopes were right. We were using RA for IPv6 because DHCP support for V6 was not supported on all our edge devices and operating systems. But even in all of this, with the DHCP scopes and the RAs and everything, we still hadn't touched the production traffic, which meant no downtime. Then once we'd done all of that, come back to the moment of truth. We basically came back in the dead of night, drank a lot of Red Bull over 2 weeks. To give you an idea, I think between three of us, we spent about $1,000 on Red Bull in a week. Then we re-tagged the edge ports into the new VLANs we'd created and simply forced the ports to flap on the switches, which caused a DHCP refresh. And with that, the moment that is done, the device gets an IPv6 address through RA, gets a new DHCP leaf, and is on the new network. And at absolute maximum, the guy was down for 30 seconds. So we managed to take the network from a completely flat network to a fully dual-stack segmented network with nobody experiencing more than 30 seconds of downtime. We then went, and once we'd done that across the whole network, enabled IPv6 on the proxy servers and the DNS servers. And this next slide is, I'll talk about that traffic swing percentage. I think it's in about two slides' time. You'll get a better idea. But with the end result, smaller broadcast domains, our switch loads were down from 90% to 3%. The network was more manageable. It was more flexible. And we had IPv6 to every edge device. Now, you'll notice I say in the slide, yes, it can be done. I've seen a lot of V6 deployments where guys will deploy in the core but not take it to the edge. It can be done to the edge, and this deployment proves it. What we see is that. That is the total traffic on the internet link for this campus. And we are hitting anywhere between 60 and 70% of our traffic is IPv6, largely Facebook, YouTube, etc. But the point is, we are running well over 50% of the actual internet traffic on V6. On the campus itself, because V6 is generally preferred, that's probably closer to 90% across that campus. With regards to what it cost us in the time, the entire exercise to dual stack this network, even at that size, took 3 weeks. The implementation was done largely at night over a two-week period. There was no downtime, and we spent less than $50,000 doing that entire deployment, most of which was on routing licenses and consultancy fees, and, as I say, vast quantities of Red Bull and pizza. Then where we're going from here, just to wrap up, we want to get a more robust multicast network on both V4 and V6. At the moment, it's purely V4-based, so we are working on that. We do have some vendor limitations there. We are also trying to reduce the oversubscription between edge and distribution and core, and further MPLS implementations. And to this end, since we actually created this presentation, we did a core upgrade on the network, and the core upgrade has got 100 gig technology, etc. The following slide, you'll actually see a design. We're also, in Q1 of 2014, we're replacing the distribution layer, which means that we'll actually be able to take a lot more V6 functionality down to the distribution instead of doing it all in the core, which will keep it also in line with what we're doing with V4. We'll be able to do things like MSDP to the distribution, and obviously there's a vast, vast increase in bandwidth on the network to reduce the oversubscription. We also want to support QoS for voice over IP, etc. This is a basic slide of what the design actually looks like, where you've got a virtual chassis consisting of two Juniper MX960s linked with a 200 gig lag, and then we run 20 gig lags to each distribution across the virtual chassis. The net result of this is you can lose an entire core router there and nothing's going to blink. You'll simply lose half the bandwidth, but everything will just keep working.
And the network, I'm proud to say that the network has now been running this new design for 7 months and we haven't had a single minute's problem with it. And so, yeah, that's a little bit about what we did. And our lessons learned is that to restructure for V6 and multicast, you don't need loads of downtime. You don't need loads of money. You do need a vision of where you want to go. You need some very careful planning and you need some very careful documentation. If you get those 3 points right, it's not as difficult as it's made out to be by a lot of people. And it does have its advantages. There is significant content out there on V6, as you could see by that graph. And yeah, so that's pretty much what we did. And I hope people found this presentation useful. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. You did better than I thought you would do, time-wise. Any questions for
Madam,
Andrew?
I would like to make some comment. Eh?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Good evening, everybody. Myself, R.M. Agwal from Government of India, Department of Telecommunications. I've been hearing a lot of discussions regarding implementations of IPv6 in the Africa region. And, of course, Government of India has come out two roadmaps as far as IPv6 implementation is concerned. So those may be useful to this region. That's why I just want to take 2 minutes of your time. We have come out our first roadmap in July 2010. That was just for sensitization of the industry and the government. And of course, some targets were given for this roadmap. Again, we have come out second roadmap in March 2012, 2013 itself. And as per this roadmap, all the government organizations have to make the plan for government implementation of IPv6 in the country by December 2013 and they have to go in time-bound manner in next 3 years' time. And all the service providers have to ready for IPv6 transition and offer the services by June 2014. And all other content providers, equipment manufacturers, they have to provide these services in a time-bound manner. So Government of India has already come out and mandated time-bound IPv6 implementations in the country. So that way, in case if any country wants any support from Government of India, you are most welcome. This roadmap is available on our DOT website. Number one. Number two, we have already going to install one center for innovation for IPv6 implementation in the country, where this we can provide consultancy services, training services, and all IPv6 related activities. Number one. Number two, we are taking IPv6 implementations not only for addresses exhaustion point of view. We are taking value in the economical and social development point of view because we are coming up with smart grid implementation in the country where more than 200 million smart meters would be placed in. So Internet of Things, machine-to-machine communications, that cannot happen without implementation of IPv6 in the country and in a global era. So as far as user's perspective is concerned, user may not feel difference in IPv6 implementation immediately, but definitely in case if we want to implement machine-to-machine communication, Internet of Things and so many other things, without IPv6 it is not possible. So I would be giving my card to you. You can display on it. Anybody who is interested in IPv6 implementation in the government activities, you're most welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that offer. Nkem had a question. You'd like Andrew to go back on his presentation?
Not quite, but I think, like I said earlier when I'm curious, in one of his outline, he said, in the challenges, he said, he talked about a disaster happening or a disaster waiting to happen. I'd really like to know why he felt not... because from what I see in the slides, though I'm not a technical person, I think it was all about putting in place a system for IPv6 migration. Am I mistaken? So was that why... I'm just curious if that was why he said it was a disaster happening or a disaster waiting to happen, because I'm like, does it mean that they hadn't any form of access to the Internet? Because for me, that is what we call for that. Or was it because they had not migrated to IPv6? I just want him to tell me why he had that in his outline. It is just waiting to happen. Thank you.
Okay. The disaster waiting to happen there was primarily because the network had been very, very badly structured initially. The structure of the network was such that we were having major technical problems because of a lot of packet broadcasts on the network, etc. And at the same time, we knew that we had to start looking to adjust this network to future-proof it and to do something for the future. That meant that we had to have IPv6. We had a disaster with the current design, so we needed to change the design. It was a combination of things, but the V6 was the disaster waiting to happen. The rest of the current design was the disaster that actually existed. I hope that answers the question, if that makes sense.
You've gotten your answer, Ken? Any other questions? We are more or less towards the end of our time. Any other questions? I see no hands coming up. I'd like to take this opportunity to just thank all the presenters and those who are in the room, those who have participated remotely. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for attending this workshop. And for those who are offering to team up with us to improve on IPv6 deployment, we are definitely going to put you to task. Thanks a lot, everyone. Have a nice evening.
Thank you.